I am going to call to order the House Committee on Health for this lovely June 10th and open up an informational hearing on basic health plan. Who's going to lead us off of this? John, are you? You're going to emcee us and tell us what we're talking about and why?
Exactly.
Good.
Okay. We don't have an overflow room today.
So no, I think there's something going on next door, so I hear House Bill 3309. That's where everybody is.
I don't want to be there to hear that.
Yes, exactly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center, and very happy to be here today to talk about the basic health program, and thank you for scheduling this as an informational discussion that we hope will get your interest today. By way of setting context about all of this, I said this when I testified back at the Interim Health Committee, is that when we step back and take a look at all of the changes that we've gone through in Oregon and being on the leading edge, I really look back to 2007, but it was even before that. I mean, we have done a number of things going back to the creation of the Oregon Health Plan, to a whole variety of things that we did in that particular program and the way in which we helped to create additional access for people. But then all of the things in recent years that we've done, from the creation of the Oregon Health Fund Board, the Oregon Health Policy Board, healthcare transformation, House Bill 2009 and the 2009 session, where basically we were ahead of the curve thinking about things like integration of physical, mental health, and dental health, as well as envisioning the exchange. And all of this was before the passage of the Affordable Care Act in 2010. And as we're looking at our implementation and the coordinated care organizations that are beginning to work and thinking about how we're going to go forward with the next number of steps that we have in Oregon, the thing that a number of us have been talking about, and frankly it started out as a small discussion, Janet and I and a couple of other people talking about basic health, but you see from the...
Did you introduce yourself? I don't remember.
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
I'll reintroduce myself.
I was just thinking. No, you did. That's fine.
Who are you?
But one of the items that we submitted was from 27 different organizations that signed on to a letter saying that this is something we really ought to explore and analyze. The Oregon Law Center, we've been supportive all along about all of the things that I mentioned, I didn't even mention Mentu, Healthy Kids, but there are a variety of things that we've worked on as the Oregon Law Center that we've been very, very supportive of and think that we've done terrific work in Oregon. Nevertheless, we remain concerned as the rollout of the ACA happens about things relating to affordability, churn, and continuity of care. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on that today because we're going to really focus a fair amount on affordability and the basic health program and why it makes sense to take a look at that. And Jana will be up in just a minute here next to me, and she'll be going into some detail about this. So our overview for this afternoon is that following me, Jana will go through a number of the details about the basic health program, the options that are before us to consider. And then we have a second panel, Alberto Moreno from the Latino Health Coalition and Arthur Towers. Alberto's discussion is really important because the basic health program allows us to serve legal immigrants that are otherwise barred from receiving services. There's a five-year bar for services for people who are here legally. And the basic health program allows us to serve that population. They would otherwise have to purchase on the exchange, and these are people that may have income considerably less than 138% of the federal poverty level. So Alberto will be talking a bit about that. Arthur Towers of SEIU, of course, as you all are well aware, SEIU has been in a leadership role for a long period of time about working with low-wage, low-benefit providers that actually served the public sector very well, from child care to foster care to the home care workers. And their workers are caught up in this discussion as well about affordability of health care. And then a couple of other things that I would say is that I hope you received the testimony from Elders in Action. They couldn't be here. They're in action elsewhere, I suppose. But the discussion about Medicare, the pre-Medicare population is really important as well as far as BHP is concerned. I think a lot of people have paid attention to the discussion going on these days about younger baby boomers, the population between 55 and 64, the pre-Medicare group, but the economy being what it is and people being having a difficult time finding work, people looking at disability tracks. If you get on SSDI, Social Security Disability, there's a 2-year waiting period for Medicare. So when we think about the elderly, there's a tendency to say, well, the elderly have Medicare and everything's fine. But in fact, that 55 to 64 population is very important. So I'll help you take a close look at that. You also got some testimony from Liz Baxter on behalf of the Allies for a Healthier Oregon. I was one of the founders of that group. We've had a number of different advocacy focuses over a period of time. And the Allies, I'm happy to say we have been meeting every week here at the Capitol to talk about health bills that are before us. And you'll see that she has some testimony that also encourages further look at BHP. You also have Oregon Center for Public Policy's really terrific paper that they put together back in May. And so there's a lot of information there, including the letter that I mentioned with the 27 organizations signing on. So in conclusion, I'd just say that we're very grateful for this discussion today, and we just want this discussion to continue. When the interim comes, I know I intend to go back to the Oregon Health Policy Board, continue to have discussion. I'm chair of the DHS-OHA stakeholder group, and I think we will surface some discussion about where we are with this. The state Oregon Health Authority, Bruce Goldberg, has been open to have some discussion about this. You may not know, or you may know, that there's a basic health program collaborative that CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, have in place, and Oregon has joined that collaborative, and we're happy about that. As Janet will point out, there are some things that have to come in sequence about how we get to there, because the feds have not come out with regulations. But we're really happy about the fact that we're having some discussion today, and we hope that there'll be further discussion in the future. And just one thing in conclusion is that as you're planning your discussions for the interim period, I think it would be advisable to consider having the Oregon Health Authority and perhaps Cover Oregon come in and give their perspective on these issues. And with that, I'll pass it along to Janet then.
I'm going to listen out of here if you identify yourself, so I don't look so stupid.
So, good afternoon. My name is Janet Bauer. I'm a policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, it's my pleasure to be here today. Thank you so much for your interest. Basic health has the potential to further Oregon's recent efforts to extend coverage to all Oregonians, as John Mullen just mentioned, at little cost to the state. A basic health program is an option states have under the Affordable Care Act for providing coverage to low-income Oregonians. Basic health would function as an alternative to purchasing individual coverage through Cover Oregon. The state would operate basic health, could operate basic health seamlessly with the Oregon Health Plan. So who could be covered? Basic health could cover residents earning under 200% of the federal poverty level who are under 65 years of age and who aren't eligible for Medicaid or the Children's Health Insurance Program. Because most children under 200% of the federal poverty level are eligible for Healthy Kids, and most adults under 138% of the federal poverty level will be eligible for the Oregon Health Plan next year, basic health would primarily serve adults with incomes between 138 and 200% of the federal poverty level. And just for context, to fall within that range, a family of three this year would earn between $27,000 and $39,000 a year. So for all who qualify for basic health would be there, would provide their coverage. They would not be able to shop in the exchange. The Urban Institute estimates that some 110 Oregonians would be eligible for a basic health program, and 72,000 of them would enroll. As I mentioned, basic health would cost the state relatively little. Funding would come from the federal government. Rather than subsidize the basic health eligible population purchasing health insurance in the exchange, the government would give the state the money it would have spent on those subsidies, and the state would use them to run a basic health program. Another key advantage of basic health is that it would likely offer much more affordable health coverage than found in the exchange. The Urban Institute study found that a Medicaid-like benefit package in the exchange with subsidies would have a national average cost to the enrollee of about $12,018 per year for one person. Well,
we're not actually offering that kind of a plan, are we, in the exchange? A Medicaid benefit?
No, we aren't. It's they modeled because they understood that there were sufficient resources to improve the benefit package over the exchange coverage. They went ahead and modeled what it would cost if the exchange did offer that more robust package, and that's where that number is coming from. So I hope that helps answer that question. And that same package in a basic health program would cost the enrollee $100 per year for an individual coverage. They also estimated annual out-of-pocket costs such as deductibles and co-payments would be substantially lower than in the exchange. It's those dramatically lower costs that make basic health a potential vehicle for boosting health coverage in Oregon. For some low-income families, the cost of health coverage through Cover Oregon may be out of reach. And my next comments are related to this handout, this one-page handout that has the figures on it, and gives some examples of premium and out-of-pocket costs for individuals, households at two income levels. And this is the illustration, the figures illustrate costs under a silver level standard plan. At these levels, the households would be able to access the federal premium subsidies and for both the premiums and the out-of-pocket costs. So looking at the examples in the second row first, we show that the premiums and maximum out-of-pocket costs for households at 160% of the federal poverty level. In the worst case scenario, these households would be spending 13% and 17% of their income on healthcare costs, respective to an individual and two-person household.
Can you go back and just help a moment?
Yes.
The premium is an annual premium or
I annualize the premium.
Mm-hmm. So it would be $10 a month or something?
On the first example, under 60%. For the 160%, those costs are somewhere between $50 and $100 a month. They're probably $75.
Which one?
The 160%. A federal poverty level
on the
second row. I'm starting with second.
Okay, you're going straight down the left.
I'm actually
bring it to the right.
I really apologize for the confusion. I thought it would be clear to talk about the higher income group first, and then return to the 60% group.
So, which group are you starting with?
160.
Bottom half of the page, right?
Not the highest one.
Yes, the higher
second highest one.
The figures on the second line regard a household of one person and a household of two people at 160% of the federal poverty level.
The bottom half, okay.
Right.
Gotcha.
I appreciate your questions because we aim to be clear, and these are helpful for further clarification of our handout. So, thank you. So, as you can see, the last figure under the figures that we have show that the premium and maximum annual out-of-pocket costs combined would mean if an individual had sufficient out-of-pocket costs, they would be spending 13% of their annual income for health care for the one-person household and 17% for the two-person household. Those costs are likely prohibitive, meaning that these households would likely not get the care they need. So looking at the example on the first line of households at 60% of the federal poverty level, they will be very likely to experience the same challenges. And I include this example because while most families at this income level will be eligible for the Oregon Health Plan and would not shop in the exchange, some legal immigrants, as John mentioned, with Medicaid-level incomes will be able to shop in the exchange if they have not been in the United States for 5 years or more and are therefore barred from participating in Medicaid by federal law. Our assessment is that these immigrant families will be nearly certain to struggle with even the modest premiums that will be expected. Oregon tried imposing premiums on very low-income households in the Oregon OHP standard in 2003 with very troubling results. Nearly half of the enrollees dropped from the program within 6 months, primarily due to the increased costs. Basic Health also has the potential to remove disruption in coverage and disruption in providers for low-income Oregonians whose income fluctuates in eligibility between the Oregon Health Plan and the exchange. Although the potential benefits from Basic Health Plan are very promising, we need more information to get a better sense of how much Oregon would benefit and how well it would fit with our structure overall. That's why we believe it's important to conduct a feasibility study of basic health in Oregon. We would suggest that study examine such things as basic health premium levels, the change in the number of uninsured in Oregon, the impact on Cover Oregon premiums, the fiscal impact on the state aside from the federal funding, and lastly, options for increased provider payments above those in the Oregon Health Plan. Thank you so much for your interest in basic health and its potential for improving coverage and access to care for vulnerable Oregonians, and for your continuing efforts to innovate in health care in Oregon. And I'm certainly happy to take any questions. Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one big general question and a couple smaller ones about immigrants that maybe Alberto can answer or you can answer. The big question is just if this is going to give better coverage for less money, why wouldn't we do that? How are we financing it? I know you want to study what's the financial impact on the state, but like, how is it getting financed? Why aren't we doing this? And then the other more specific is just around immigrants. Do they qualify for the subsidies, and are they eligible to be penalized if they don't purchase health insurance as everyone else is?
Mm-hmm. Answers to your first question, Oregon isn't doing it now because it needs to have federal permission to do it. There needs to be an agreement between the state and the federal government to conduct a basic health program. And the agreement.
Would it be fair to say we're not doing it because we haven't asked for it?
Yes. Yes.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, also, in fairness to the state not asking, is the regulations. We won't have draft regulations out until this fall. And so while a number of states are actively discussing this, and Janet and I are in on conference calls from around the country, the idea came out of the program that Washington had, and Maria Cantwell put this amendment into the ACA and saying this is the way to deal with this, and the legal immigrant issue was added, as well as the 200% FPL.
Chair Greenlick and...
Can I ask for a follow-up on your question? She asked, how is this financed? Could you say again, how is this financed?
Certainly. The basic health program would be financed by the federal premium and cost-sharing subsidies that would otherwise go to individuals, eligible individuals in the exchange. So if Oregon were to run it, the HHS would agree to, instead of doing the subsidies in the exchange, provide the equivalent amount directly to the state so it could operate the program.
And Mr. Co-Chair, if I may add to that, it's one of the reasons why an analysis is going to be important. The preliminary information we have is that states can do just fine and be able to afford this with no additional state funds being put forward by just using the subsidy money in a different way.
So it would be the subsidy money and a premium?
Yes.
Not general funds.
Non-general funds,
right. I understand that there is... that administrative costs are not included as a eligible use of the basic health funds. There is some details on those provisions in the Affordable Care Act that still need to be worked out. So we will be much clearer when the rules come out exactly how those funds can be used and how to what extent they can be used for administrative costs. But it would be in the administrative cost area that Oregon is likely to incur
some
costs.
Let me follow up on that. If this person at 160% goes into the exchange, his health care is financed by the subsidy and his premium.
Yes.
No, you're saying if he's in the basic health plan, his health insurance is going to be financed by the subsidy and his premium. What makes his premium so much less in the basic health plan?
That's, I think, what I was trying to ask.
In the exchange,
sure. Right.
Because it's the same two sources of money for an even better plan in
right.
the basic health
right.
plan.
It relates to efficiencies of the Oregon Health Plan and lower provider payments, most likely, those two factors.
And not running through insurance.
Right.
I mean, that's the big difference.
Well, does it really not run through insurance? I mean, even our health plan runs through CCOs.
Well, right. Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, really what this does is it creates a Medicaid or CHIP-like program by extension for 138 to 200% of the federal poverty level. So we believe it could be run seamlessly. And of course, eligibility functions when the exchange gets into open enrollment, when Cover Oregon begins October 1st, it's all going to go through that same portal.
But these people would be in CCOs then, just like other Medicaid?
That would be a choice that, if I could respond, that would be a choice the state would make. It seems to us that would be a logical step to consider to essentially build on the CCO structure that we've worked so hard to put together and to extend that to individuals at some slightly higher income levels. So
this may not be shared by my colleagues, but I don't have a sense of, I don't understand what we're talking about.
Oh, Mr. Co-Chair, let me take another crack at this, if I may. Janet used a good example of when we changed OHP standard and started charging people premiums and people just dropped out. And one of the things that we're worried about is that that very low-income population is not going to be able to afford, and they'll just simply not show up.
Well, I understand why we want something like this.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in healthcare a long time, and my magic wand is really, batteries are really low in it, so even with my low battery magic wand, I'm not sure I understand how we take the same amount of money, let's call it lead, and then we move it over here and it becomes gold.
Mm-hmm.
And that alchemy is something that there must be a secret here, and it's possible my colleagues have, they can.
Chair Greenleaf?
I love changing lead to gold, incidentally. It's a very...
Chair Greenleaf, if I could respond there, that's the question that I've asked. And not only has the Urban Institute done analysis, but several other private entities have done state analysis, and they all conclude that there would be lower premiums possible through a basic health program because of the efficiencies of the state program. And that is largely, it's largely because of lower provider payments.
Well, we could solve that same problem in the exchange if we got them all to agree to only take half of the money they would otherwise get.
Right.
We save a lot of money that way. What makes you think they'll agree to that here? Hey, we have this great new deal for these people that now have health insurance, and you've been collecting full amount of money from them, and now we're going to collect half amount.
One of the issues that we believe is a concern is that individuals, if they cannot afford the premiums in the exchange, will not sign up, and they will continue to go uninsured.
I've been worrying about this all along, so to we're in the same worry.
Right. So to the extent that individuals can be insured, it's I want to say I don't want to anticipate how the insurers would respond, but there is some hope that the provider payments could be somewhat higher than in the Oregon Health Plan, and there would be opportunities for more folks covered in the in uninsured individuals in Oregon covered, which there may be some efficiencies on their end as well. I guess what I'm getting to.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just add to that, is that this is one of the reasons why we believe study and analysis is necessary, mm-hmm. because these large national firms that have done this work, there are unique features in Oregon. For example, states are going to be pretty different, it appears, as to what the how products will be sold on the exchange, what it will cost. California and Oregon, at least, are showing that competition seems to have brought the prices down. So the gap between all of this needs to be studied pretty closely so that we can say this is a good deal. We'd all agree this is a good deal for the people signing up. This would be better for them. But the question about affordability, can we afford it as a state, is something that needs mm-hmm. something above my pay grade to do that kind of analysis, and specifically for Oregon.
So I see three areas where you could possibly lower the cost, which would enable you to use the same money and get better coverage. One is reducing provider payments, and are you thinking that you would reduce it from the commercial rate to the OHP rate? Is that what the thinking is? Or somewhere in between? So, okay.
Yes.
So that's
those would be the two options.
Okay.
Yes.
Another is, obviously, you cut out insurance. You cut out the middlemen. And mm-hmm. as you said, because of increasing competition, that gap may be getting smaller. Mm-hmm. But that would be another area. And the third area is if they did go in the CCOs, the whole idea of delivering care in a more cost-effective way and having people with diabetes not go into the hospital twice a month at $3,000 a pop. It seems like without that, it's really hard to find the efficiencies to do more coverage for the same price. That seems like a critical component to me.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Kenny
Geyer. For service versus
The thing that, one of the things that our alcohol insurance commissioner, Lou Savage, said is when he came to talk to us as the Allies for Healthier Oregon, is basically we're resetting the marketplace through a number of things that we're doing. And there are some things that I can't totally get my arms around about how one thing leads to another, which is why we're just saying we wanted to have this general discussion today and have further discussion and see what options would be best for Oregon to make sure that we don't have this big gap for people below 200% of federal poverty level. One thing that we will know by the time we're back in session in February, I hope not sooner, but when we're back in session, we'll have a chance to understand what open enrollment looked like from that period of October to the end of December. We'll have some understanding about what the uptake was for that population, 138 to 200%, to know if they came forward to sign up. and maybe we need to retool outreach, but maybe the issue would wind up being flat-out affordability. And so for our goal to cover people who are very low income, while all of this, everything from what we're doing in Oregon to what the ACA means, there seems to be some places where we believe that lower-income people are going to be adversely affected.
Because the other alternative to pursue would be to increase the subsidies at the lower level dramatically. Mm-hmm. So one is basic health program, and the other is to consider that, including below OHP levels for those that are not eligible to buy into the exchange.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, there are some other options that are floating out there that that other states are exploring mm-hmm. as well. So again, you know, Bruce Goldberg and OHA are they're very interested in looking at what comes next, but they're also they got their eye on what comes now. And so basically it's just a sense of we're all going to be at this for decades about figuring out how to make all this work. Maybe that's an exaggeration, but it's going to be a number of years before we see how all of this falls out and how it works.
And I hope you're not interpreting this as lack of enthusiasm for exploring this option. I'm just trying to understand yes. where how yes. how you do that magic wand. And then back to the immigrant questions. Do you know if they're eligible for subsidies and if they're also eligible to be penalized if they don't purchase?
Chair Greenlake and Representative Kenny Geyer, I know that the legal immigrants are eligible to shop in the exchange and receive subsidies for both premiums and their cost sharing. And I don't have a, I'm not sure about the answer to your second question.
And Madam Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, I don't know the precise answer either, but if you had somebody that had zero income that was a legal immigrant, you know, there would also be the economic hardship provisions under the ACA that would pertain. So yeah. I don't imagine anybody would ever be fined.
Right. Okay. Representative Thompson.
One of my concerns about the everything we're doing, and it's also reflected here, is that we seem to be tied up with reducing the cost to the patient and reducing the cost to government, but we're not hitting the other side of the equation, and that is the cost of delivering medicine. Mm-hmm. Now, some of that is by model. I don't believe physicians are great business people. Mm-hmm. They certainly aren't trained in that, and that's part of the problem. But we're dealing with a system that it is what it is, and we have to somehow attack that because I don't think I have any physicians in my district now that will accept any additional Medicare or Medicaid patients. Mm-hmm. They have up to whatever their book of business will allow them to have, and that's it. So I have people from Dallas going to Silverton to get medical attention, whatnot. And so it's just it's not a great system right now. And what I'm hearing is discussions about further reduction of the number of patients they will accept from these income populations. So we're going to, if we don't do this right, we're going to end up with a really great coverage plan for all of these people that they can afford. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, they can't find a provider. In dentistry right now, it's gotten so bad, there are a number of practices here in Salem for sale. The first line of their description is they are not an OHP contracted practice. Mm-hmm. That's a feature benefit for value of a practice. That's not making me feel real comfortable that all of this is washing out. And, you know, maybe it's everything from the cost per square footage of medical buildings right on through the cost of supplies. But if we can't attack that end of it somehow and educate medical people how to do business more efficiently, you know, we're not going to get there because they're simply either going to not accept the patients or go out of business because they can't make the books balance.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Thompson, I don't
see
where this all addresses that problem.
Well, those are very good things to point out. One of the things that's interesting and instructive to learn is that before the RFP went out for CCOs, there was worry that nobody was going to show up. And, you know, like if you take the HealthShare of Oregon, which is in the area where I live, seeing the counties and providers come together in that way. And also, I think that this is something that I believe to be the case, but of course, we're looking off into the future. As we start to have people that are more middle class that have come into the exchange, and we look at the effect of OEB and PEB, the people that participate in all this, it begins to me, I'm hopeful for this, is that healthcare becomes less of a low income and reimbursement issue, and it becomes about how we do business and how we serve people. And as somebody famous once said, implement the hocus pocus of the triple aim. I really think that we have the potential of getting there. Any of you haven't read The Bitter Pill, the article that was in Time magazine, I really recommend it to you because it's just really eye-opening to see the way the delivery system works and how all of those internal cost centers operate and all that. And it's like quantum physics to me looking at it.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
And we'll be close by in case there are questions.
Are you done?
No, I'm. We have the next panel.
No, I know.
That did conclude my testimony. I appreciate your time. Thanks.
All right. Mr. Moreno? Mr. Towers?
So for the record, my name is Arthur Towers, political director for Service Employees Union Local 503. And I wanted to talk today about and really update the committee on conversations we've had previously in session around the coverage for the 25,000 or so care providers that our union represents. We represent 17,000 in-home care providers, 3,700 adult foster care providers, 2,800 child care providers, and 1,500 workers in skilled nursing facilities. And so many of these workers are directly publicly funded by the state. And then I would argue there are tens of thousands of more workers that are quasi-publicly funded in the private sector. In addition to nursing homes, we're also talking about workers in assisted living, in group homes for people with developmental disabilities, hospitals, people who work as mental health providers, and drug and alcohol counselors. Many of these jobs are low wage. Much of the work is less than full time. And the other thing I think that's important is that these are growing occupations. And so we've really started to dig in with our home care workers about what the different possibilities are here. And I'm afraid, based on the last panel, I'm going to be longer on problems than I am on solution, but we'll give it a whirl. So again, with the 17,400 or so care providers we represent, they basically max out at $10.20 an hour. They 4,200 of them have health insurance currently, and the other 13,000 don't. Only about 6,000 work 80 hours a week or 80 hours a month or more. And their work rises and falls based on the needs of their clients. So caring for people in the twilight of life, occasionally a client will pass away, and so there'll be a month where a worker may have fewer hours. Or for our employment-related daycare providers, for example, a parent may get a raise and no longer qualify for subsidized daycare, or the parent may lose their job. And so these wages go up and down, and these workers are going to be struggling with making the premiums work. Several years ago, we sought to enroll child care providers in the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, FEOP, which helps pay the premium for private health insurance. And that insurance program required a very low buy-in, but we found it very, very difficult for childcare providers to even make the, it was less than $100 a month, I believe it was less than $50 a month, premium share to make it work. Because at those wage levels, it is that extra, you know, $30, $40, $50 might not be available. Might need to go to keep the lights on or something that feels more immediate than the health insurance premium. And so, you know, we think, so with our home care workers, we're struggling to make some changes and make some improvements and explore the options that the Affordable Care Act provides. So with the 17,000 home care workers, we think that about 10,000 will qualify for expanded Medicaid. Another 1,600 or 1,700 or so are over the age of 65, so they qualify for Medicare. And so that means that about between 5 and 6,000 may be eligible for the health insurance exchange, but may not be able to afford the co-pays and premium shares, even with the tax credits. So we're going to fall directly into the area that may be benefited by the basic health program. And so you know, we're very curious about the potential for this. We appreciate your interest in it. We look forward to, we urge you to kind of delve into it and see what the possibilities are. We feel that perhaps the exchange, as it develops into an active purchaser, could achieve more of the efficiencies that were discussed earlier on and reward providers that tackle some of the overhead questions and business practices that Representative Thompson alluded to earlier. But we think that this might be the basic health plan might be an approach too, and so we're very interested in how this might unfold. And I'm happy to talk a little bit more about our exploration of basically what we're talking about doing is foregoing traditional employment-based health care for 4,200 of our members in order to pursue care under the Affordable Care Act. And at that point, I'm happy to stop and answer questions or turn it over to Mr. Moreno.
Hey, it's your pleasure. Mr. Moreno, you want to take a shot and then we can ask you both questions?
Chair Greenlick, I'm more than happy to take a shot at this, although I should disclose that I'm not an architect in the room, so I can answer questions about this community. My name is Alberto Moreno, and I'm the executive director for the Oregon Latino Health Coalition. I also have the privilege of serving on the Governor's Commission for Hispanic Affairs, and it is indeed my pleasure to be here with you today. I'm here to testify in support of a basic health plan option for Oregon. We believe that a basic health plan option is good for Oregon and Oregon's workforce. This is especially true for immigrant communities who are here legally. And I want to repeat that. We're talking about communities who are here legally, but who are otherwise categorically ineligible and excluded from receiving Medicaid-sponsored health services. Specifically, basic health would help extend health insurance coverage for legally present immigrants who are otherwise barred for the first 5 years of legal residency, also known as the five-year bar. This is something that appears to not be on anyone's radar, including our friends at OHA. This notion that there is a subset of legally present adults who can't legally access the health plan. And so we see this as a possible solution to remedy that gap. The immigrant community, as you know, plays an important role in our economy, and their health affects all of us. Farm workers, for example, contribute over $5.3 billion to Oregon's economy each and every year. And the Latino community alone wields over $7 billion, billion with a B, in buying power in the state of Oregon alone. Unfortunately, many of these legal immigrants do not qualify for Medicaid. By federal law, immigrants with Medicaid-level incomes must wait 5 years. If you earn poverty wages, as in the case of a farm worker, by the way, their salary has remained less than $10,000 a year. And so if we talk about that, if we think about that, and we agree that a monthly rent is $600 for these workers, and you multiply that times 12, you've already swept away $7,200 of a $10,000 annual salary. And so you're left with less than $3,000 to buy food, to buy clothing for your children. Certainly can't pay for uniforms. Certainly you can't pay for health insurance. And so this is real for our communities, and it's something that we hope to be able to explore with you. I want to repeat, I think that's what we're here to do. Today we're not asking you to adopt a basic health plan. We're asking you to help answer questions about a possible solution. From our perspective, we think that we're leaving federal dollars on the table. And so to the extent that we can leverage and capitalize on those, I think it would serve us as a state. Basic Health is perfectly positioned to reach legal immigrant Oregonians temporarily barred from Medicaid. And based on existing studies, costs could be much lower under the basic health plan than in the exchanges. And this may have to do, I'm not the expert in the room, but it may have to do with federal matching rates, which are certainly more handsome than not getting them. In conclusion, a basic health plan option can help this vital workforce get insurance, keep their coverage, and see a doctor when they need to stay healthy. The Oregon Latino Health Coalition invites you to support the exploration of this possible solution for all those who currently don't qualify.
So I assume there must be some rationale behind 5 years versus 4 years versus 1 year. I mean, I'd like to understand a little bit more why that period, how they accepted or come to 5 years versus some other time or none. I mean, I understand a little bit why they would argue none, but nonetheless. So is there some significance to 5 years?
There is no legal significance behind the five-year bar. Looking back at the history of those decisions, it seems fairly arbitrary. There's a notion that legal immigrants should pay into the system before they can draw from it. Not necessarily an argument or a rationale that we agree with. Clearly, the healthier the workforce, the more productive they are. Their ability to access health care on the preventive side limits our expenses on the emergency room side. We have policies that are driving the kind of health behaviors that we abhor. We have policies that are driving the kind of health behavior that we can't afford. And so to the extent that we can realign those policies to foster the right kind of behavior from our immigrant communities, I think we're a better state, we're a richer state, and everyone can have a more robust plan, have enhanced services, get the care that they need when they need it.
I have a similar question, but I wanted to start by thanking you, Alberto, for being so present this session. I'm sure you've been very present in previous sessions. I'm new to it, but you're standing up and advocating for people that generally don't have a voice in this arena is making them a healthier population, which makes Oregon a healthier population, and really thank you for your constantly bringing that home to us. I have a bigger question that probably is not appropriate here about how can their average salary be only $10,000 when you have someone working at minimum wage times 40-hour weeks times 50 weeks a year being somewhere in the $17,000 realm. So it makes me think about, even if they're legal immigrants as opposed to illegal, are they still subject to wage theft and other things? It's a bigger issue than just here, but so the bar question, is this a federal restriction or is it a state? Is it federal?
Hi, Representative Kenny Geyer, thank you for your question. Before I answer your question, I want to say that this question of voice requires a chorus, and thank you for joining in that chorus. In terms of the five-year bar, it is a federal rule, but states can opt out of that federal rule. And in fact, several states in the union do. I can't name them for you off the top of my head because I'm getting older these days. But it is indeed something that states can opt out of and allow legally present immigrants to make use of Medicaid services.
So as a follow-up, do you know, does it require a change in statute or is it an administrative up to the Department of Health?
I don't know. My guess is that it would require a state plan amendment or a waiver, one of those two. But Dr. Goldberg's office certainly would be the authority on that, as would legal counsel.
Hmm.
It seems counterintuitive to have that five-year bar for legal immigrants when probably the first 5 years is when they would be earning the lower salaries without promotions, and denying access to health care might not be a really good idea, and that problems delayed for 5 years aren't going to get any better. Mm-hmm. I mean, kind of like, are we on a health care path or a disaster path? We kind of take choose which way you want to go, but not logical.
Representative Thompson, your assessment from where we stand seems both rational and accurate to us. It makes no economic sense. Certainly not only do these hardworking immigrants have deferred care needs, but now they have the opportunity to financially participate in a healthcare system that only gets more robust the more people participate in it. And so it is those kinds of policies which we would argue have a built-in bias or costing us money. One can then begin to ask the question, what is the cost of our bias on a national level, on a state level, and then ultimately on a human level? And so we appreciate your question.
Well, I'll just follow up and say that I completely agree with that, because when you think about CMS covering 60% and the state covering 40%, it's a, you know, you're tapping into significant federal funds to include them as part of the Medicaid eligible population. Exactly. In addition to preventing illnesses and emergency room visits that cost our own healthcare system. So
I would just want Vice Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, I'd just like to amplify on this point for just 1 second, because we talk about questioning the logic of a public policy decision around the five-year bar. And I would bring it home to decisions made by this legislature to put tens of thousands of care providers into poverty by electing not to fund the positions at a higher level. Right, the same sort of arguments about 10-20 an hour workers, or in the case of child care workers, sub-minimum wage workers, who are then turned around and reliant on public assistance in other sorts of ways, or are uninsured, or face other consequences of the state decisions not to pay a living wage. I would argue those public policy decisions have the same lack of logic in the overall scheme of things. And, when you look at the sort of savings that are achieved by the state by employing this sort of community-based care system, I would be remiss not to mention that the lack of logic is
right.
A little bit more widespread than one might think. And I'll restrain myself at that point.
Yeah, yeah. We could all keep going there.
That's right. I'd like to ask, so just so I understand, what you're suggesting here, mm-hmm. as part of the study, that you believe potential, if we had this basic health program, mm-hmm. would allow more opportunity for your members in that aren't covered now versus some of the things you've already explored and talked about, that right. this might enlarge the group of those people that could be covered?
It might be another tool, Chair Greenlee, Representative Lively, it might be another tool in the toolbox, I think, for the state to develop a wider variety of services, a wider variety of coverages. I think that, again, we'll have the exchange.
Right.
Can we get the exchange to a point of being active purchaser? We'll have a basic health plan. We'll have expanded OHP. There's a variety of ways to tackle this challenge. We'll have the reforms of the delivery system that this committee and others have worked so hard on for a number of years now. I mean, I'm excited by all the different possibilities, and we ought to just find out whether or not this is another viable possibility.
If I may, I wanted to echo Arthur's comments. I think the reason Oregon is being looked at as a health leader is because we haven't been afraid to innovate. We haven't been afraid to ask questions. We've created that kind of permissive environment that allows us to ask questions that have a return on investment. We think that this proposal, this exploratory question, is one of those that could potentially fold in people into the care that they need and not leave federal funding on the table. And so we hope to count on your support to explore this question and get concrete, specific answers about how it would work.
Well, tomorrow, my vice chair and I are meeting to talk about the work plan for the interim. And I think we're going to have too many requests for work groups specifically. What I would suggest is if your allies that are interested in this question, if we could create a bill to introduce in the February session as a way to trigger discussions, further discussions about this. In fact, if we could have it ready by the September meeting, I'll not be here. I'll be on the phone, but my vice chairs will be handling that meeting. If we could get ready to have a formal bill introduced that we could then leverage to have hearings and feedback and things that might tell us. Would that sort of thing work? Is that, would you sense that is a good way to start this? So, Jim? Melissa, does that make sense? Well, then we'll await working with you on that.
And any informal work that wants to continue.
That's right. I mean, it would be very useful. I'd like to figure out before then what the magic is in this that makes that work. But I think that would be a good way to start.
Thank you.
That would make some sense. There are obviously, I'm very worried about that same gap you are. In fact, I'm also worried about the gap of young people above 200% who find it more economically feasible to pay the tax or to think they can skip the tax. And that's a population we need in, but this 138 to 200% population really worries me. So, it's right in the sweet spot of where we need to go next, and it is the question we need to ask.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank the four of you. Thank you for keeping this idea alive for us, because this clearly seems an important place. Anything else, team? Mr. Vice Chair? Madam Vice Chair? Okay, we have what's the rest of our schedule so far? I think that
we're meeting Wednesday and then one Monday.
What's the topic Wednesday?
Hear about clinical pharmacies.
And a week from today?
Monday we'll hear from Central Oregon and an update from them.
What's going on? I expect that will probably be about the end of when we make that decision
we're
tomorrow.
We're putting off the hearing on designer drugs until the interim. We have a scheduling difficulty getting the guy in.
Okay, we schedule that for September.
Mostly my fault because he was scheduled for today and I didn't realize it.
Scheduled for when?
And did you?
Today.
Did you?
We had time.
No, it all fell apart, but it was just.
Did you get a chance to check with your wife to see if we could do it any earlier, the barbecue?
Wait a minute, let's.
We're still working.
We're adjourned.
Maybe we'll move it up half an hour or so, but.